And I think that just feels crushing to so many young guys in particular who are like, I don't even know how to make my car payment. So I don't know how to find my purpose. My response to that would be purpose as I think being misused in these conversations. Mm-hmm. Having a purpose doesn't mean you have figured out your life path and career trajectory and income sources and relationships. I think purpose is more of you figured out that you have a compass and you can remember to look at it every once in a while of which direction you're going. To me, purpose, and when I talk to young guys, I'm more interested in them trying to cultivate a kind of a code, a set of values of who they are and what they will and won't do. In some ways, it's boundaries, but it's deeper. I mean, it's a code. And to me, I think that is really what people are talking about when they say purpose. So for me personally, I feel like my general purpose is pursuing.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Easy Conversations podcast, a podcast about having easy conversations. I'm your host, Verkan Dandia. This week's episode, I'm joined by investigative journalist and author Will Potter for a detailed discussion about the manosphere, male loneliness, purpose, and the search for connection in a world that is feeling unstable. Instead of reducing young men to stereotypes, we try to explore the deeper emotional and social needs that make online gurus and ideological certainty appealing. Together, we discuss healthy masculinity, the purpose of strength, why isolation can become dangerous, and how asking for help can create relief rather than shame. Our conversation ultimately points toward a healthier path, including values, community, responsibility, emotional honesty, and connection. Will Potter is an investigative journalist and author who has spent more than 25 years documenting political repression around the world. His groundbreaking books, Green is the New Red and Little Red Barns, exposed how protesters and journalists are criminalized as terrorists. He is the creator and host of How to Live in a World on Fire, an upcoming show about finding strength, purpose, and connection in times of crisis. Please check out all the ways you can find Will online, including his website. And before we jump into the episode, a quick reminder that the content on this podcast is for educational and informational purposes only and should not be considered therapy. Listening to this podcast does not establish a therapeutic relationship. The views are expressed independently of my therapeutic practice. If you do need assistance, please reach out to a licensed clinician. Now, let's just jump into the episode. Will, welcome to Easy Conversations. Thank you for joining me today. I'm really excited. We've had the opportunity to speak before and felt like we could have kept going.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, but...
No, I appreciate you having me on, Verkan. It's great to talk to you.
And
I
absolutely.
Appreciate the work you're doing.
Thank you. Yeah. And likewise, right? So that's why you're here. I really want to pick your brain on a lot of the things you've been doing. And I was kind of preparing my notes for our conversation. I was kind of overwhelmed and like, oh man, there's a lot to talk about here. So
there's a lot to talk about.
We'll see. Yeah, exactly. We'll see how it goes and where it takes us. But yeah, I am curious about your journey, and I find the work that you're doing very, very fascinating. It comes with obviously some risk as well. Maybe I'm minimizing the risk, but happy to hear more about it. And I guess just to kind of start off, I'm curious if you could share a little bit about yourself, who you are, and what it is that you're doing in the current chapter of your life.
Yeah, when you said journey, I'm like, oh man, it's been a journey. So I started writing I'm an investigative journalist and author, and starting a new project, which kind of brought us together, we can talk about. But I started writing in newspapers when I was 17 at the Dallas Morning News. And from really early on, I felt like this was the path. You know, journalism to me has always been about the kind of old muckraking models of speaking truth to power, comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable, you know, that kind of trying to make a difference and use story and the idea of witnessing other people and witnessing their stories to make change. And specifically, you know, through kind of a strange chain of events, the focus of my work pretty much my whole life now has been on political repression, meaning the ways that industry and state power use that power to silence protest, to silence marginalized groups, protest groups, journalists, whistleblowers, people that are trying to do that work of bearing witness and exposing what's happening. And so it's been a long path. I mean, that started out in many ways just right after 9/11. I was at the Chicago Tribune and I was visited by FBI agents at home, and they threatened to put me on a domestic terrorist list unless I helped them infiltrate protest groups. And so in some ways, that's kind of where it started for me. But yeah, it feels like it does go back further than that. This has been a lifelong path.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And how do you see journalism in today's world? And where do you discern between actual journalism and what we could call sensationalism, right? How do you separate the two? And what are you seeing in today's world? And how is that journey, or just even what you've seen it evolve as? How has it evolved from your perspective?
Yeah, I've been in that question a lot lately, because I think it's a mix of really, truly heartbreaking to me, but also infuriating. And what I mean by that is I think we've arrived at this place. How do I answer that question? So when I was coming up, I was already seeing the decline of newspapers, the decline of magazines, traditional journalism paths. It wasn't out of reach for me. I might be dating myself, but it was still early enough in the internet that people are like, oh, we might figure this out. Now, fast forward, we've never figured it out as journalists and as society, how to sustain a free press in a digital age.
Yes.
And I think where we've arrived is a place where traditional news outlets are crumbling. Investigative journalism and foreign correspondents are really the first to get hit over the years. But now we're seeing a lot of towns with no local papers, no local news to speak of, nobody going to the city council meeting, the school board, planning and zoning. I mean, this is where our lives are most affected. And we don't have journalists who are trained and who understand the values of the craft out there doing the work. So that scares me. And then it also really scares me that I feel like media literacy is just disappearing. Mm-hmm. And it's shocking to me. I don't think this is an age or gender or class issue. It feels like across the board, our media literacy is just going into the dumps. I mean, I have friends and colleagues that and family that every once in a while I'll get sent something on social media and I'm just like, whoa, like they've arrived at a different point in the algorithm.
Yes.
And they're being fed this and they think it's real. So to me, I'm starting to feel like a species going extinct a little bit. And a lot of my colleagues are feeling the same. We're not quite sure to where to go from here. It feels like culture doesn't value journalism the same way, at least not willing to pay for it or protect our safety or our freedom. And it makes it harder and harder to justify those kind of risks you're talking about, because it's real. I mean, in the US right now, which is where I'm based, we're seeing journalists arrested, home raids by the FBI, journalists being threatened with imprisonment, deportation, stopped at the border, being called into court. We're having everyday people on the street taking photos of ICE and human rights abuses being classified as terrorism. Yeah. So we're entering a really dangerous phase right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Are you able to speak to some of the personal costs you've had to incur, and what has that been like for you? I mean, you shared that one example right after 9/11, but I'm sure there's probably more there.
There is. And I always have kind of mixed feelings of how to talk about it, because in the scheme of things, compared to colleagues, especially colleagues in Gaza right now being murdered, colleagues around the world, it's not that big of a deal, but it's affected my life quite a bit. That FBI experience was the first. And then over the years, I worked with lawyers at the Center for Constitutional Rights, and we got a stack of FBI and counterterrorism unit files that were about my work, speeches, articles, They had a write-up of my book. They were noting correspondence I had to prisoners, emails I had to people. Mm-hmm. So that's chilling because you see tangible evidence of, okay, I am being monitored. This is not a tinfoil hat thing. This is what happens when you start getting a little bit of attention and speaking truth, like I said. Mm-hmm. And then there's been like the kind of third party consequences, which are increasingly dangerous, especially in the States and a lot of places throughout Europe. Well, in Canada as well, where you have these far right groups and other extremist groups that are doxing journalists, which means releasing their public and personal information to intimidate and also to have real world consequences. So I was doxed, and that was quite scary. And on the heels of that, I had some experiences being targeted by an underground neo-Nazi group that had a history of violence against journalists. So I say all that because it's been stuff like that. For me, all things that are this kind of like code orange, right? Or maybe code red. And I think the effect it's had on me most is living in that state of orange to red and just always being a little bit, I'm even feeling that today when I got up, just a little braced for impact. Even though I should be safe, we're having a great conversation. And I think that's what this kind of work often does to people.
Yeah. And what I'm hearing is that's the whole point of the intimidation, is to basically force you, right, in a way to not do the work you're doing. So how have you been able to stick with it and keep going? And how do you keep yourself grounded when, you know, like even like as you're sharing right now, waking up and having that feeling, how do you ground yourself and how have you been able to stick with it?
I'll be honest, man. It's been a slow burn of learning that. I feel like I've been a very slow learner. In part, I grew up in Texas. My dad and uncles, you know, cowboy hats, handlebar mustaches. Like, I just had no vocabulary for any of this. And I feel like I showed mental health, like depression, as a teenager, and that was like shut down. And so I moved through a good chunk of my career feeling like I have no right to acknowledge this because I'm not in Iraq. I'm not in the red zone. And, you know, I'm not seeing people murdered in front of me, that kind of thing. And it wasn't until I got to Michigan, I got a Knight Wallace Fellowship, which is a big deal in journalism. And a number of war correspondents pulled me aside and were like, we need to get you checked out. Like, they just saw it in my eyes, the PTSD and just the long-term burnout. So to answer your question, it's been a really long path. You know, I started off trying to just do the cognitive behavioral therapy, think my way through this. And over the years, I've arrived at a different place, I think, where what I'm trying to do right now on an ongoing basis is, I guess, more somatic, more really trying to be in my body and understand what's happening in my body and take measures to start with my body rather than start with my thoughts. So that has been the most helpful. Most days it's still a struggle, to be honest, but like the things like getting out, morning sun, going for a walk, steady exercise, weightlifting, eating right, not drinking, you know, all of those things have a cumulative tangible benefit that I'm honestly relying on more than a lot of the therapy or kind of like trying to will my way through this right now, you know, starting with the body.
For sure. No, I appreciate that. And I think a lot of people I talk to that are either experiencing improvements or noticing improvements in their mental health are doing a lot of these things that we often forget and take for granted, right? So I think it's worth emphasizing that. Now, maybe to shift a little bit, you talked about whistleblowers and, you know, I remember when I was doing my engineering in one of the ethics class, I've shared this story before, they kind of made us watch this movie. It was Al Pacino and a Russell Crowe movie. It was called The Whistleblower. I don't know if you recall that one. It's fairly old, but you kind of see, you know, the idea is there's two whistleblowers in the movie and you see the consequences of speaking up. What I've noticed is, especially with the space of podcasting and the way media is unfolding right now, maybe it's become easier to be a whistleblower. What are your thoughts versus what you've seen over the years?
I think a couple of things are happening. I taught a class years ago at the University of Michigan about whistleblowing, and we kind of geeked out on this, like, how has it changed? And so to geek out just for a moment,
sure.
You know, when Daniel Ellsberg released the Pentagon Papers, he was a contractor. Mm-hmm. He had access to these. He went and snuck into a copy shop at night and was photocopying by hand. And then they had to be released by hand to the press, distributed by hand. And I think we lose sight of that. So flash forward, technological changes and things like WikiLeaks and open platforms have allowed for the release of terabytes of data. So in some ways, that plus I write a lot about undercover investigators and the availability of pinhole cameras, cheap equipment or inexpensive equipment, editing software, distribution software, all much easier. While at the same time, though, as that's been happening over the years, it's become more and more dangerous to be a whistleblower. Mm. I think sometimes we think about this as being a partisan issue, but it's been nonpartisan. Mm-hmm. Under the Obama administration and the press, attacks against journalists and whistleblowers and subpoenas were at an all-time high. So what we're seeing right now is kind of a different breed of animal from that, but I think it's both. It's gotten easier and it's also gotten much more high stakes.
Okay, fair enough. And along those same lines, you've done a little bit of work as well in your book, Green is the New Red. You kind of talk about activists being labeled as terrorists. And that was kind of one of the things you talked about even after 9/11, you being asked to infiltrate. Say more about that, right? Like, I think that's definitely, we're seeing that right now too. Over the last 3 years, you kind of made reference to ICE. I would say even with some of the protests we were seeing with the whole Free Palestine movement and all of that. But like, how do you see that happening? And to me, it sounds like this has been going on for a while, but I just want to get your thoughts.
Yeah, it has been going on for a while. It's also, it's ramping up, like you said. It's starting to feel ubiquitous. Mm. Like, I think we're just seeing that language everywhere. I mean, I think the campaign against Palestine advocates is a great example of not accused of illegal activity, not accused of violence, not accused of threats. Mm-hmm. Their just existence and their belief itself is now labeled as a terrorist organization. And we got to that point, I would argue, it's been decades. This didn't even start with 9/11. In my research, I found in the 1980s, you had corporations really trying hard to label environmentalists as terrorists. They made up this new word. They hired a PR firm called ecoterrorism. Mm. And if you remember at the time, though, there was other terrorism taking place in the 80s. Yeah. You had plane hijackings. You had hostages and bombings. Mm-hmm. And people didn't really buy it. And that continued over decades. And then when 9/11 happened, you know, I think a lot of people would be shocked to know that as first responders were still trying to get into the Twin Towers and into the Pentagon, you had members of Congress openly speculating that it was the work of environmentalists because of eco-terrorism. So just to hit that home, like from literally ground zero, corporations were feeding those talking points to politicians. And from that point on, it kind of hit the ground running. So a lot of my work over my career has been really charting how this started and how it's evolved. And it's really gone from groups that were labeled more radical. So people who, environmentalists who were vandalizing SUVs or blockading roads or stealing animals from fur farms on the animal rights side, things like that, clearly illegal, not terrorism, but you know, felonies.
Yes.
And it's shifted over the years to photographers, to whistleblowers, which I talk about in my last book. And now, like you said, we've arrived at this point where just being connected to something like, you know, Palestinian advocacy, you can be labeled a terrorist.
Now,
historically, my understanding is, because I've read about Gandhi, and from my understanding and perception, he was kind of the first mover in that peaceful protest side of things. And you can kind of, whether or not you're familiar with it, it had a significant impact, right? Whether it was in South Africa, and then you kind of took it to India as well against colonialism. Do you feel that noticing the impact of that, perhaps the response was into that, like, okay, this thing has a powerful effect, we need to combat it? And do you also see similarities with union workers when they tend to protest for their rights? And
I think those are great examples, and I think a really important point to hit home, that, you know, my focus and my work is on authoritarianism, political repression, but that's always in response to the success and the potential power of people. And often it's very, very small groups of people that are threatening in terms of making worried very powerful people and powerful industries. And I would argue that's kind of the history of social change. Gandhi was an example of that. You know, in Gandhi's time, we hold him up as being kind of the architect of this, but there were lots of other different groups working at that time, some of them quite violent. Some of them were breaking into prisons and stealing, you know, and releasing prisoners and activists who were arrested, attacking cops. And what I've kind of taken from all of this is that all of those pieces are seen as a threat to people in power generally. I think there is something about that, like that mass organizing potential that really kicks it to another level. And so that, in my mind, is how we explain why the FBI labeled environmentalists their number one domestic terrorism threat for many years, even though they've never actually harmed anybody. I think it was that the organizing potential, FBI files talk about how they're changing culture. So it is part of that pushback against the potential for real social change.
And a lot of the things you're touching on perhaps comes back to media literacy, right? So a lot of it is around schemas and how things are framed. But then there's the whole idea of patterns of misinformation and fake news. How do you tie all of that together? And you're talking about people who are in powerful positions are threatened by these things. Perhaps it is like some of the organic stuff that happens, right? Grassroots organizations that are taking the initiative. So where is this misinformation, fake news coming in, and how do we become a bit more literate around the media's role in this?
You know, I think we need to understand that it's always existed. As long as there's been any form of mass communication, you've had people in power trying to manipulate and control that or shut it down and censor it. So there's always been this spectrum of censorship to propaganda. And somewhere in the middle is kind of co-optation of media outlets. And I think we're seeing all of those right now. We're seeing outright attacks on journalism, trying to censor it and shut it down, imprison and scare journalists. But we're also seeing this co-optation. For instance, if you look at the White House press corps, that, you know, Defense Department, or excuse me, the War Department, telling journalists that they had to get out unless they signed an agreement that they're not going to be critical of the government. Instead, replacing this with literally teen influencers who have never done any real journalism and are kind of sensational parrots for the administration because they're trying to get their moment in the sun. To me, that kind of sums up the landscape right now. And it's a little tough to wrap my head around it, because it feels like just a couple of years ago, fake news, as it was being said by the Trump administration, was so radical. You know, he's calling journalists the enemy of the people. And now we're like, he's raiding journalists' homes. And it's normalized. So I don't know if that's quite answering the media literacy point, but I think that's part of it. We're both illiterate, I think, of how structures of power and a free press work, kind of that systems analysis. I think we're ignorant of how journalists actually work, mm-hmm. that it's not just saying journalist in your Instagram profile. Like, there's methodology and training and ethics and a craft.
Yes.
And I think we're also illiterate in how we consume and what our diet is mm-hmm. of media.
Yes.
You know, one thing I'd always used to ask my students in first day of journalism classes, tell me where you're looking for your news. Where do you go?
Yeah.
And they're working at the paper. They're active. These are really smart students. Almost everybody is holding up their phone. Mm. I'm like, okay. So whatever the big tech company is mm-hmm. telling you should be in your feed, how do you feel about that? Mm. Should we have news judgment or should Meta have news judgment? Should the editor or Instagram? Mm. And I think we've kind of lost sight of how those choices are being made for us in terms of our media literacy.
Yeah. But if people don't know any better and they're not even aware that perhaps the news they're being exposed to is controlled, mm-hmm. then how do they even step out of that and seek out different sources of information or question what they're seeing?
I think the first step is really restraint. So mm-hmm. let's step back a half a step and say, I think folks need to understand that as human beings, we have a confirmation bias mm-hmm. that's incredibly strong. We mm-hmm. want to believe what we think we believe. Mm-hmm. And part of that is it's reinforcing safety and it's a way of forming community. We can kind of talk about where that came from. But the science shows we have it and we seek out things that, you know, light that lamp for us. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And if we acknowledge that, that's not a bad thing. It doesn't mean you're a bad person. It doesn't mean you're stupid. It just means that we do that. If we recognize we have this tendency, I think it means we need to pause and take a beat when mm-hmm. we're looking at social media or we're seeing something that I always would tell folks, if you see that news article or that clip that you're immediately like, exactly, that's what I've been saying. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's eliciting just this 100% response.
Yes.
Take a moment, especially in the wake of not just tragedies, but major news events. Mm-hmm. We're in a digital era where we're expecting journalists to work faster and faster. So even if real journalists are doing the story, mistakes are getting made.
Yes.
So I think we start with that restraint, take a breath. And then from there, you start to think about like, well, who is this? Mm. Increasingly content creator.
Yeah.
Who is funding them? Mm. What is their motivation? What is their background? Is this just fun? Or is this situated in my life as being the news I'm consuming? Right. Mm. I think we're not being critical of the line between the two. I feel that when I scroll, it's like, okay, motorcycles, tattoos, self-help stuff, masculinity. And then it's something that's like, it's commentary on the news. Mm. Is it news or is it someone's hot take? Mm. And so I think that's where we have to start from.
Yeah. Yeah. And especially noticing like we live in a world where it's become more about clickbait and rage bait to get that immediate response. And what you're talking about is often what I like to help men understand, especially that's where my work is centered on, is taking that pause, right? Especially when it comes to some sort of emotional reaction that your body is going into fight or flight. So just mm-hmm. to your point, take that deep breath and just ask yourself, do I need to respond right now? And part of the propaganda, I feel, is centered on eliciting an emotional response. And one of the biggest ones is fear. People tend to respond to fear, right? So how are you seeing the weaponization of fear and how is that basically shaping people's perception and their behaviors? I know we've kind of touched on it from the media side, but in general, right? All around us, I feel there's been, especially I think during COVID, it became a lot more obvious for many, many people in terms of how fear was being propagated. But you can go back in time and you can see it always being there. So how does that shape people's behavior and their perceptions?
I mean, it's such a critical part of this. And one, to give a kudos to you for reminding people of that pause. I think it's not, like you said, it's not just when we're scrolling, it's in interpersonal conversations. I mean, we're talking about me and PTSD earlier, like I have to actively fight that. So I do, just to give that a bump, I think that's a muscle we have to cultivate, especially as men, when we're just valued for anger sometimes. But fear is connected to all that. So I think we need to remember that fear, in a lot of my work, fear has felt like a character. Like when I was writing Green is the New Red and Little Red Barns both, fear felt like not just a theme, but a presence in the work that I needed to acknowledge and talk about, because it's both a political idea and a political weapon. You know, I think the fear, as I see it right now, it's starting to shape how I'm even viewing our collective response to this moment. So if you think about post-traumatic stress and PTSD, the research generally talks about our response as being fight, flight, a freeze response, which we don't know what to do, we shut down, or increasingly fawn, which means, you know, when you are connected to the person that's harming you and you try to lean into that to protect yourself. And what I see what's happening in America right now, it feels like fight, flight, freeze, or fawn. You know, some people are fighting back. We're seeing at Delaney Hall right now. It's kind of not in the news, but there are people in the streets trying to keep their neighbors from being interned at a concentration camp without charge and without recourse. So they're fighting. There are some people that, you know, doing the Rosie O'Donnell or the, you know, leave the country, the flee, that this is too much. And some of that's very valid. And I think some of it is a fear response. I think a lot of us are freezing. I think a lot of us, I think probably the majority of people that I'm talking to feel like we're in a freeze state right now, that we don't know quite how to respond. Like we see how bad it is and we are scared, but we just are stuck. And then I think that fawn is the, I mean, frankly, it's the bootlicking response. It's the, what the GOP, everybody's trying to cozy up to the authoritarian because they think it's going to help them. And so my view of fear is really through that lens. And I think to push back against that fear, we both have to acknowledge it and normalize it, that we're all experiencing it, and kind of do it collectively. Like in a lot of talks I've given over the years and book tours, when you talk about this fear in a group, it has a different tone than when you are talking about fear by yourself or with a friend. Like it starts turning into action. Then I think that's how we respond to fear.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I would have guessed, I'm seeing just from the outside a bit more of the fawn response, just based on how people, to your point, are standing behind the government irrespective of what's happening. Right. So, but it's interesting. Yeah. I think I could agree. Maybe there is more freeze where people are just kind of in a holding pattern, not knowing what to do. I can definitely get behind that too.
Well, and I think kind of regardless, we can move between those states. Right. And that's kind of the crazy making of moments like this, is it our nervous system is bouncing with these. So it's like, we're not stagnant, but yeah, I think the more we can see that we're even in a state to begin with is part of what I hear from you, Furqan, of taking that breath and okay, what's actually happening right now? What am I feeling?
Absolutely. And there's an idea of identity, right? And maybe you can talk about identity politics, but in general, I find the sense of belonging, and I've talked to many people about how gangs recruit susceptible individuals. Generally, they're targeting younger men, but you can make that case in identity politics too, in today's world, where perhaps younger men are more susceptible to the propaganda. What are you seeing, and maybe this might be a bit of a tangent, but also something we really wanted to touch on this conversation, was the manosphere and all of that. I found it very interesting, maybe a bit of another tangent or aside, how you see the podcast world, for example, and how there's like four categories that you're observing. It would be worth, if you don't mind sharing that, because I think that's pretty fascinating.
Well, yeah, and it's all, this grew out of my focus on repression and authoritarianism as part of that, you know, the rise mm-hmm. of the far right. And what I've been seeing in the manosphere that we talked about, you know, it's often characterized as kind of this pipeline of, you know, young guys can get into somebody like a Joe Rogan, and then they are being fed things about Nick Fuentes and Ben Shapiro and Fit and Fresh and more kind of misogynist, extremist, far right folks. Mm. And I've started to view it a bit differently. Like, I think all those different components of what we're calling the manosphere have different entry points where they're attracting young men. A lot of it is about belonging and a lack of purpose. They're catching them quite young. The research shows that as soon as boys create social media accounts, they're being fed far-right content, both YouTube, Instagram, TikTok, in about 20 minutes. So they're being pushed in this pipeline. What I try to emphasize to people is that it's not just a pipeline, it's more of a sewer, in that all of these are kind of the manhole covers, whether it's, oh, I'm listening to Andrew Huberman, we're just optimizing our life. That kind of can feed into an Andrew Tate in the algorithm if you're not careful. But the sewer is that there's even more radical groups underneath that are capitalizing on this and continuing to draw those young guys in. And I think that's what a lot of this conversation about the manosphere is missing. Like, I love the Louis Theroux documentary. I think it's great that we're starting to see how, frankly, vapid and hollow a lot of these guys are. Like, they don't have substance. They're hypocrites. They're frauds and grifters. I think we need to point that out. But we also need to see that behind them is a rising movement that's much more dangerous. So for instance, to me, I'm particularly concerned about the rise of active clubs. These are, it grew both in the US and Europe. It's kind of taken over everywhere now. It's not a new model, but this active club model is fairly recent. I remember this from back in the day, growing up in the punk and hardcore scene, that there were groups of neo-Nazis that would train and fight together. And as punks and anarchists and leftists, you had to do the same. And now it feels like that on steroids, because these groups are actively training both jiu-jitsu, boxing, paramilitary tactics, and they want violence. And so I guess that's a long way of saying my thinking here is that unless we directly confront not just the grift, but the politics and the hollowness of what these men are pushing, that appeal of belonging and brotherhood is going to keep sucking guys down into that sewer. And, you know, one last point on it, I guess I'll make, is that the research shows it's not about beliefs. It's not about ideology. I was just talking to a researcher the other day, and she was like, you know, everything we have shows these guys aren't like diehard racists. They're not getting into it for the racism or the misogyny. They're getting into it because they feel like they belong, like they're able to be accepted. They have like-minded people. They're part of a community. And that's, of course, not excusing any of that, but I think it complicates it to say that, okay, well, what if they're not persuaded by any of those arguments? And what if they're just looking for a better place to fit in? And that's what I'm thinking about a lot now. Like, how do we create something like that?
Yeah. So what does one do? Because there's a lot of things you touched on there. So I'll try my best to pick up the threads here. But so what do you do as a young man if you're just wanting to be physically fit, you're training, right? Like, I train jiu-jitsu and I see a lot of young guys come in and it does benefit them, right? So how do you parse out the fact that maybe there is a risk there and maybe you are a target potentially and susceptible to it versus I'm training on a Friday night instead of going to a bar and perhaps getting into trouble. Yeah. Where's the fine line there, right?
It is a fine line. I guess I would first say that there's nothing wrong with wanting to be strong and wanting to be fit and to, you know, the internet talks about locking in to young guys to get your objectives and to hit your goals. I'm kind of the same way. I understand all of that. What I would say is, particularly when you're younger, you need to have your radar on of, and your defenses. You know, we want to talk about combat sports, boxing and jujitsu. Yeah. Keep your chin down and your fist up. Like these guys are, they're seeing you as prey. They're not seeing you as a buddy and a little brother. They're seeing you as someone that can funnel in to their literal pyramid scheme of Hustler University with Andrew Tate, or all these guys have courses and stuff.
Right.
So just be skeptical. And I would say, in addition to that, be wary of any message that's encouraging you to isolate and just kind of like put your head down and focus on yourself while listening to some guru type figure. That's not a healthy combination. If anything, I think, you know, I understand this impulse. Like, if there's popular memes that, like, you know, a guy gets rejected on camera, and then there's a guy in the gym that's kind of like, welcome, brother. Like, let's get to work. Or a guy on a motorcycle that's like, all right, welcome to the club. That's fine to do that a little bit, but don't let yourself get pulled into that isolation, because that's how they try to radicalize you. Be around other guys, do your research on the gyms that you're going to, be careful about how you're investing your time and energy, because some of these folks are just vampires.
Yes, absolutely. And you talked about the susceptibility also coming from a lack of purpose. And I put myself back into my late teens, early 20s, and that purpose piece is so difficult to define, right? And as you and I both can appreciate, it evolves, right? So much over the years. So when you're kind of like fresh and you're not even sure of what the world is like, it's just that much harder, right? If someone comes in and be like, hey, here's a purpose that you can pursue. And we're all seeking meaning in life, right? And I found it through education and academics, but who knows, right? If I hadn't found that, what else I could have pursued, right? So it's really tough. And I think one of the things I wanted to ask you about, it's probably a good time to bring this in, is masculine mentorship. Right. So I don't see the importance of mentorship being emphasized enough, especially for young men. And I believe it's something you have to almost seek out yourself. Maybe you're lucky, maybe you have an uncle or a cousin or a family member or someone close to you that may take you under their wing. But outside of that, you almost have to initiate it yourself. But we're not taught that as young men, that, hey, surround yourself with mentors that can guide you at times.
I think we're taught the opposite, that if you're really a man, you grit it out. You just fight and figure it out. And I think this mythology of this self-made man, the hyper-independence, I mean, there's a lot we could talk about where that comes from, but it's one of the primary weapons of that manosphere, because it's keeping us focused on ourselves, on isolation, on this self-destructive idea that whatever we have is just because of us. And those are all really limiting beliefs. You can't build big things by yourself. You can't have enriching life experiences and connection by yourself. It's setting aside the fact that it's just not possible. To your, what you were saying at the start, it's not just, I think guys are struggling with the purpose. It's, we also have to figure out how to pay the bills. And I think a lot of us are feeling like, we don't know how to pay the bills. Nothing seems stable. Also don't know how to navigate X, Y, or Z, like relationship, friendship, life. But then on top of that, the influencers online are like, what's your why? You know, what's your purpose? And I think that just feels crushing to so many young guys in particular who are like, I don't even know how to make my car payment. So I don't know how to find my purpose. My response to that would be, purpose, as I think being misused in these conversations, having a purpose doesn't mean you have figured out your life path and career trajectory and income sources and relationships. I think purpose is more of you figured out that you have a compass and you can remember to look at it every once in a while of which direction you're going. To me, purpose, and when I talk to young guys, I'm more interested in them trying to cultivate a kind of a code, a set of values of who they are and what they will and won't do. In some ways, it's boundaries, but it's deeper. I mean, it's a code. And to me, I think that is really what people are talking about when they say purpose. So for me personally, I feel like my general purpose is pursuing journalism, bearing witness, fighting fascism. In terms of the specifics, how to do that, it varies day to day, week to week, month to month. But I think having a very clear code for myself of what I will and won't do and say or work with people I will and won't work with helps shape that. And I think it creates... I'll even go so far. I think it creates a perception for people that I have a much more clearly defined path than I feel like I do. If that makes sense. I think we need to get folks to really articulate those values rather than the purpose and the outcome.
Yeah. No, I appreciate that. And it does make sense. I see, you know, we've touched on it, but I see the problem is for many young people, you're constantly exposed to the flashy things, right? Especially with now the exposure to social media, for example, and influencers and those type of people that are perhaps showing you a way, right? And that's where I think it becomes that much harder. You talked about the optimizers, which is interesting, right? Because, and I want to get back to the other types of perhaps categories you're seeing, but it's interesting with the optimizers, you can make the argument, well, look, they're helping you become better, right? They're sharing educational resources. They're sharing things that allow you to be a better person. So where's that risk to your point? I know you made a very specific example that, you know, maybe you follow a Andrew Huberman and that could lead you down to the path of a Tate, right? For that matter. But how does that become a risk?
I think the risk is in thinking that we can optimize our way out of social crises and personal crises. And I'm not against the optimizing. If anything, I have to watch that I don't fall victim to it.
Right.
Because I think that's part of a PTSD response too, is like, okay, control what we can control. And I think that pushes a lot of guys to really try to dial in their routine, feel like they got to get up at 4:30, hit their macros, do all these things. That my concern with it is we're being kind of fed this idea that if we do that, that that's enough and that will get us where we need to go. And I think that's just fundamentally flawed. I mean, from my own personal experience, but also conceptually, like, okay, even if you do all that and we all get jacked, and we're all following our macros and our schedule and we're making money and selling crypto or whatever they're telling us to do, right? Is that resulting in a meaningful life? Is that resulting in like what we, in our deeper levels, saw ourselves as little boys wanting to be in the world? And I think for most guys, it's an obvious no. Now, maybe that's a component of it. Like maybe it helps boost our self-esteem. Maybe it helps meet other needs. And by all means, do it. But I just think what I'm seeing in the manosphere is that there's just an absence of any acknowledgement that part of the problem is we need to go inside. We have to go internal. Everybody's telling us to go external. They're either telling us to do the cold shower, cold plunge, hit the gym, all that stuff. Or they're telling us to go external and worry about trans people and immigrants and Palestinians and all this. It's always somebody in women. How about instead we look at like what's actually going on in us? And I think if we start from that and try to optimize that, we get a lot more benefit and a lot more rewarding life. And it's, you know, it's tough, man, because I think that's a harder pitch, especially if there's any young guys or people with young guys in your life watching this. You know, you're 14, 15, you're trying to figure out how to not get made fun of.
Yes.
Hopefully how to get a date. Hopefully how to just be passable, you know, and have some friends. And I think the Mammosphere is trying to prey on those insecurities rather than challenging these young guys to have more in their life and to really aim for more.
But it's, to your point, it's such a hard thing, and it's not as popular, right? Not as exciting to go inward. But I do agree with you, right? At the end of the day, a lot of the examples you're giving, it's, to your point, externally focused, and it's so easy, especially in today's world with the access to everything we have, to fall into a comparison mindset. And you just feel like you're not never enough, which is a huge focus of my work, is around shame, where you're constantly telling yourself you're not enough, you're not worthy, you're just feeling like a failure. But it's, to your point, turning inward and looking at yourself in the sense of comparing yourself to who you were, right? And the progress you're making. And again, even in that, you're going to regress at times. It's not a linear journey, but that's where you can feel grounded, right? And that's part of the challenge. I don't think a lot of people are talking about do the inner exploration. It's all about the external validation.
Well, and I don't know. I'm curious your thoughts on this. I mean, maybe part of that is how we're framing this too. Like it is doing the inner work, but another way of looking at that is doing that inner work so that you can have a bigger external life, right? And have a, I'd always talk to my students about the idea of a literary life of just like, I got into journalism and writing. I was reading The Beats. I was reading Hunter S. Thompson and Upton Sinclair, St. X, these people who had these like larger than life personas and adventure. And I really have come to think that to get to that level of when we see people and we're like, whoa, how did that guy get that crazy audacious life? I think it has to involve, you know, both the somatic work, sitting with yourself and what you want, and doing that inner work. So I don't know, maybe it's a branding question of like, maybe we need to pitch the bigger life that's possible rather than the difficult internal work, but they feel so connected.
Well, I think what I've learned, and this is something I try to point out to people, is if you're able to connect with yourself and go inward, that allows you to, ideally, you want to be at a point where you accept yourself as you are, right? So you're not putting on a different mask depending on the situation or who you're around. So I think, you know, in terms of those examples you shared, if you're comfortable with who you are and you've accepted yourself and you've met yourself where you are, then you can be the same person wherever you go. And then that's where you can have that impact, right? So for me, I try to look at it as like, am I the same person when I'm around my children, around my wife, when I'm working with people, amongst my friends? And if there's any friction that I'm feeling or this need to create a different persona, then to me, that means, okay, there's more work to be done. And that allows me to come back. Yeah, it allows me to come back, and whether it's part of my meditation or journaling, to sit and ask myself, why was that coming up for me? Because
we do feel it. I mean, we all know it does feel uncomfortable, but we don't do that second part that you're describing of sitting with it and trying to see like, well, why? Mm-hmm. Where is that discomfort coming from? Mm-hmm. And not to bounce around for company, it reminds me of, you were asking about that landscape of the Mammosphere.
Yes.
In hearing you say that, just reflects to me all the pieces I see in that Mammosphere landscape.
Yes.
Are falling into this trap, right? Mm. I mean, if you look at it, we have like the what I call them, like the anxiety grifters.
Yes.
It's like the clavicular, just constantly reminding dudes like, we're not enough. You're not attractive enough. You're not, you know, all these things.
You don't have enough money.
You don't have enough money. Yeah. Like, you're just failing. Mm. Then you have like the kind of reasonable contrarian types that are making guys feel like they don't know enough because they're not understanding about immigrants and minorities and women, the kind of Ben Shapiro's, right? We have these kind of optimization bros.
Yes.
That I think Huberman is part of that, but also like a Steve Bartlett and I think Scott Galloway is in there. That are just like, hey man, you got to figure out how to make more money faster and like dial in your productivity. And then we have these outright fascists like Mick Fuentes that are explicitly white supremacists and are telling you a version of that insecurity, which is the fascist narrative that you were nothing without the state. You're nothing without the bigger monolith of American nationalism and power. And so I just want to highlight that because I feel like all of those are doing exactly what you said. They're tapping into this anxiety. They're telling us we're not enough. And they're trying to feed us as men, like a clear pathway out of that, that benefits them. I'm not seeing anybody in that mix that's trying to carve a pathway out of this for men that is actually benefiting men. It feels like all of this is, we're just being used as a tool for all these different types of what frankly feel like grifts to build other people's followings and other people's bank accounts.
So in that, are you saying that it comes back to their personal benefit and it's not necessarily doing anything for their audience per se?
In terms of the manosphere kind of writ large? You know, as a journalist, I'm hesitant to the sweeping, but I'm also inclined to go there. Because it's like Andrew Huberman. I'm not saying he's far right. I don't know anything about him. I'm not saying I bring him up because I think he's adjacent to this world. I don't see bad intentions, but I also see that it's not addressing the issues at hand. Scott Galloway seems okay, but he's also talking about how Ben Shapiro is a great guy. And he's telling young guys they need to prove their value to women by making money, that that's their role. I think this is bullshit. Like, I'm not hearing from any of these guys in this space actually talking about justice, talking about, like, the heart of it for me, man, is like, all these people, we're all talking about strength.
Yes.
Rogan, all these guys, everybody's trying to get fit, appear strong. What is our strength for? Why is no one talking about what our strength is for? Is it for a masculine value of protection and standing up for people? And if so, maybe we need to have a call to arms right now of why men aren't out in the streets defending our neighbors who are under attack, defending our, you know, not to say women and children, but this is kind of the, if we want to buy into this narrative, then y'all need to walk the walk. And instead I see people like Rogan. They love to talk about jujitsu and they love to talk about their like grappling and combat strength, but it's never for fighting the good fight.
Yeah. I mean, so I guess to play devil's advocate, like,
sure,
we can also acknowledge that we're all inherently flawed, right? So perhaps you can make the argument, well, maybe they're doing some good and they're not aware of their own shortcomings or their blind spots, but they're also making themselves vulnerable by putting themselves out there, right? And open to criticism. So is it all bad, all good? I don't know. Like, you're, to your point, you can't necessarily make a sweeping generalization, but if I'm a young man and, you know, even someone of my age, like if I'm listening to some of these guys, who does that leave? Like, who do I then listen to? Or do I listen with a objective ear and pay attention to where can I derive the benefit and then discard the rest and not necessarily make it a part of my identity?
I think that's a really important point, also because we were talking about that belonging and community before. And the reality is, for a lot of guys, You know, if everybody in your immediate friend group or at the gym or at the shop or whatever is listening to Rogan every day or listening to whoever, you know, there's that element too, where it's difficult to just reject this entirely. So I would encourage guys, like, we have to have that media literacy and that degree of skepticism. And in addition to that, if you're consuming this, I'm not saying there's not some value to it. Hell, man, with a lot of this, part of my motivation of my work right now is that as I've been on this healing journey or whatever you want to call it, of trying to acknowledge and do the work myself, I'm being fed this stuff. I'm meeting people in my spaces of weightlifting and motorcycles and the things I care about that are listening to these guys. And I think you're right. Like, some of it is compelling because it's acknowledging that, like, hey, dude, no one's coming. Like, no one's got your back. You got to step up. You know what I mean? I think there is a lot of this that is really appealing, but we just have to be careful with that confirmation bias and also asking ourselves who is really being served. And I think if we do that, a lot of this, especially the manosphere, there might be some entertainment value. There might be some community you feel. I don't know how often we can say that that's actually serving us and helping us grow and get bigger. Even if you, I've talked to some of the guys, younger guys that got like red pilled and really got pulled down that pipeline. All of them said at some point they kind of had this head above water moment of realizing, like, I'm in an alternate universe now and my life isn't better and this hasn't fixed anything. And I think that's the danger, is you arrive at a point where, how did I get here? and why is nothing different?
Well, it's, as you're sharing that, it reminds me of this analogy I use quite frequently, is the frog in boiling water, right?
Oh, yeah.
Right? So the temperature is being turned up slowly and you're not noticing it, right? So what you may have perhaps opposed as a view or just even thought there's something wrong with it, because it's slowly being ramped up and you're slowly putting your guard down, it just becomes a part of your thinking and your ideology, right? And all of a sudden, before you know it, you're agreeing to things that you may not have agreed to in the past if you would have had that objective or skeptical mindset at times.
And to go even a step further, in psychology and like media theory, sometimes you hear this idea of inoculation theory. It's this concept that, like, you're giving people little injections of concepts before giving them the full blown.
Yes.
I think that's what's happening with the manosphere. We see it with fitness influencers now, that all of a sudden they're dropping in little mentions about ICE, little mentions about different political things, and connecting kind of fitness and influencer content to starting to put a toe in the water of those politics. Another example of like how this came home close to home for me, I was in this veterans group and these guys kept telling me, oh, you should meet this buddy of ours. It's a shame he couldn't come to this retreat. You would like him. He's, you know, covered in tattoos. He's way into CrossFit and weightlifting and jujitsu, and he's into metal, and like, you like him. And I started putting it together and finally realized I did know who this dude was. And he was part of some really dangerous, dangerous far right folks. And I say that because of both like how this can come really close to home all of a sudden for men without realizing it. And also what you're speaking to of, and when I'm hearing that kind of inoculation theory of just like, yeah, we're just like you guys. We're interested in the same things. And then they kind of push a little bit further and you start hearing more of what they actually believe. And at that point, you're getting pulled into the community. You're getting pulled into the belief system. And that's kind of the short of how radicalization works. They're meeting a need for belonging and strength and identity, and then they're turning that into something that it's much more dangerous.
And as you're sharing a lot of this, one of the things that's coming up, and I talked to James about this too, one of the challenges I see is people are unwilling to have a open and respectful conversation, right? So one of the things I enjoy about doing a podcast is sometimes people come on and they share their views and opinions on things, and I don't necessarily agree with it, but it's interesting for me. It's definitely a skill I've had to work on to sit here and just listen.
Sure.
And then perhaps I can go do my own research and understand, okay, where's all of this coming from? But it is an opportunity to learn. But if what I see, unfortunately, is people are so closed off that if you challenge them, they'll fire back with sarcasm, put you down, make fun of you, ridicule you, right? And then the opportunity for dialogue is lost. And a lot of it is obviously easier to do behind a screen. But even in person, right, I hear so many stories of people losing contact with friends, family members, just because of their view on the vaccine or just their view on what COVID was. And you can now extrapolate that into the political landscape as well. And unfortunately, there's no dialogue, right? So what are your thoughts on that? And what are you seeing?
It's I wish I had the clear answer on this because I struggle with it. Mm-hmm. Everybody, all the men I know are struggling with it to some degree. I've arrived at kind of two kind of bellwethers or two key points on that. I mean, I'll say, first of all, if, especially to the guys listening to this, if you have friends that are kind of adjacent to that world or maybe in it, don't feel the need to immediately just cut ties with these dudes. I think we need to see this. I know it's difficult. I know it's uncomfortable. There might be some awkwardness and some tension, but you need to take some ownership that if you are removed from their life, they might be in an echo chamber after that. They might get pulled full on down into that sewer. And I know, you know, it depends on our bandwidth and what we can, can carry in relationships. But if you have the bandwidth, try to stick with it. I think by being curious is the best way to do it. So rather than trying to convince someone to debate, to argue, to have a throwdown about it, try to start from that curiosity of like, well, tell me, how did you arrive at that? What makes you think this? Where do you think that feeling comes from? Like, try variations of all those types of kind of inquisitive nature. And I think it disarms people. It gets them to reflect a little bit and say, they might say, oh, I saw this on such and such. And then you can follow up. It's a gentler way. And I think a more, I don't know, I may even say brotherly. Like, it's like a way of engaging with each other that you're not just trying to attack, but you're actually trying to learn about your friend and what they. So I think that's the first point. The second part of that is recognizing that there are limitations to that, both of you, what you personally can handle and what your values can handle.
Right.
And if you found yourself around guys that are making you feel like garbage and you're getting pulled into this stuff, or they're making comments about women or minorities or whatever, that you're trying to be curious, you're trying to speak up and it's not working, I think it's okay to cut ties. I think that goes with family too. And this is such a personal question that sadly there isn't like a checklist to figure out of whether to be estranged from family or to kind of remove yourself from a friend group.
Yeah.
But I would just say it can be on the table because sometimes this reaches a point that I've had to do this with some friends and some family that I'm like, we're not going to meet anywhere close to what feels like a middle. And even if we got in the middle, that that still doesn't feel right to me.
Yes.
Because you're so far in this dangerous, evil territory. So I'm struggling with it too, man.
Yeah.
Regularly. I try to be the best I can, but like, it's hard not to isolate sometimes. It's a little bit easier.
100%. And even if you're physically isolated, to your point, you can be in that echo chamber and not feel like you're isolated, right? Because you have this sense of belonging. And that's the tricky part of it all. Whereas maybe in the past, without any internet, you're kind of forced to engage with people. Otherwise, you'd be completely isolated. I think I agree with you. The curiosity piece is really important. I think there's boundaries too, right? Whether boundaries around maybe there is cutting some level of contact or reducing it, but also having boundaries around, we can talk about these things to a certain extent. And beyond that, maybe we can respect the fact that we're not going to agree. So let's not go there, right? So at least you're still maintaining ties and relationships. But it all comes down to curiosity, but also some humility around knowing that we don't have all the answers, right? As much as we like to think we do, there's... And I often look at it, I also wonder, right, when I see some of these things that are happening. I mean, we've touched on Palestine, right? And I wonder, like, how are other people looking at this and how do they see it differently? Like, I just find it fascinating as a psychologist, right, that there's obviously people are convicted in their way of seeing things a certain way and the belief and perception they have. So I find that fascinating and obviously want to understand. But again, with certain restrictions and limits.
Well, and I think that humility is so important because it's also, I think we have to be humble about how we got to the point that we are. Not that, you know, we're obviously so enlightened because we're talking about this on your podcast and everything, right? But it's like, even in the research on marketing, how many times you have to get hit with the message before you start hearing it?
Yep.
How many times you have to be to learn about X, Y, or Z issue before you start processing. And I think to me, that's what I try to be most humble about. Yeah. I have friends who I thought would never have been vegetarian forever. And that for some groups of friends, that's always a thing that's just like, we're not going to talk about.
Yeah.
And I'm amazed by, I've had people from way back be like, who gave me hell for years and then are like, hey, you know, I picked up your book or I saw this thing you did or I thought more about it and I'm doing this. And it's just like, if you would cut off those relationships at the moment of tension, you don't allow each other to just kind of just soak it in a way, right? Of like, we need some time for our bodies and our minds to process some of this stuff. And sometimes it takes a while. So be there for that process to happen with your friends.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I thought we were agreeing on everything until you mentioned you're vegetarian. So
see, this is what happens, man.
I'm just kidding. So we've talked about media literacy and the responsibility that we can all take. So what are some things we can do? I know you've talked about many, many things, but if you had to kind of distill it into key things people can focus on or even takeaways as far as being aware of radicalization and the misinformation that's all around you, right? And the biggest thing I took was personally, and then, you know, you can add more to it, is noticing when you're having that emotional response and just pausing, right? I think that's first and foremost for anything, but what are some other things people can do to just become more aware of some of these things?
Sure. I think that's a whole... The whole spin off. We have to have a follow up conversation here. I think what you describe is one of the key components of that, of just day to day life as a survival mechanism and also interpersonal survival, is taking that breath, taking that beat. You know, I think another key part of this is like we have this narrative in our culture that we can heal in isolation, that we can figure things out. And increasingly, the research shows that we actually heal in community. So for guys who are listening to this that are like struggling with depression or anxiety or your life or money, I started to feel at one point like I got to figure all these things out before I can reinvest in my friendships or in my romantic relationships, right? And I think that's just wrong. I think we just have to be social. And so if you don't feel like it, it doesn't matter. It's like going to the gym. It's like you force yourself to text the friend, send the stupid memes to your group chat buddies, check in, get on the call even when you don't want to. Like, it really is that important. And I think through doing that is one of the best antidotes I've found to just keeping a lot of this stuff at bay. Because when we have real interpersonal connections and we have real friendships, we have to depend less and less on third-party parasocial relationships on the internet, right?
Yes.
You know, I'll throw in, I think another piece of this is it's really kind of driving me nuts. I've lost a number of friends and family to suicide. I see other people struggling with this. Mm-hmm. I've seen it. I grew up in the punk and hardcore community, and recently there was some kind of high profile situation with this. And I hate the, like, we just put up the suicide hotline number or we tell someone to go talk to somebody. I think we got to, like, bulldoze past this point of it's not enough. And we need to get more specific on what guys can actually do. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you should reach out to a friend, but you should reach out in the sense of tell someone if you're struggling that bad.
Yes.
Ask for, we talked about male mentorship. Mm-hmm. Ask your guy friends. Sometimes we have to be blunt with each other. Mm-hmm. Hey man, could you really give me advice here?
Yes.
Or, hey man, could you just listen to me as I, like, word vomit all this stuff I'm freaking out about and tell me if I'm being crazy? Mm-hmm. Like, there's ways of doing this that aren't like the, you know, kind of self-helpy and therapeutic stuff we see online sometimes.
Right.
But get to the same purpose. And so I think those are some of the best tools I've found of just being really blunt, and turning to your, I've turned to friends repeatedly and been like, okay, I need to run this by you because I feel like I'm an anxious mess and I'm not going to make a good decision.
Yeah.
Can you help me make a good decision? Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of it. Don't let it get to the point where we're just posting suicide hotlines and telling guys to say how they're feeling, because it's not cutting it anymore.
Absolutely. And the other thing I would add to that, because I see or hear so many men say, I don't want to be a burden and share my problems with anyone. And it's for anyone that's listening or in general, what I like to remind people, you're not being a burden. I think what I've, in my experience and what I've observed, and someone on the receiving end of it too, if someone were to reach out, I'd be more than happy to help, right? And I haven't met anyone who wouldn't agree with that, that if someone really needed something. And that's where that community piece is so important, that we are social creatures. And, you know, whether you, in the times of tribes, we were all supporting each other. So it's in our DNA, right? It's not like that because we live in a more disconnected world, and obviously we're, our communities have shrunken, that that's still there within us. So I think just asking for help is not being a burden.
I would even go further than that of being like, I think we need to talk to men about asking for help as actually creating relief.
Yes.
Not just for you. It's creating relief for the other person. Mm-hmm. Because chances are, and I've struggled with really dark depression for a number of years, I knew there are people that loved me, but they didn't know what to do. And I didn't know how to ask for what I needed. And so for the men listening to this, like, trying to say, hey, it would really help me if you could help me move, or if you could help me clean my house, or if you could do this, might be received as a genuine relief. Because then it's like, oh my God, now I know how to help my buddy now. And I think it's also a relief, because by you being vulnerable, it allows a container or a space where your friend can do that too.
Yes. Yes.
And sometimes I think what we, all we're really needing is just that barrier to be broken.
Correct.
Because more often than not, when I feel like, oh, I'm humiliating myself, I'm talking about how bad I'm doing, like, oh, I'm a bummer. And the guy I'm talking to is like, no, dude, like, I'm struggling with the same thing. And it's just like, you can feel it's a tension release. So again, to just to try to reframe this, I know that feeling, it does feel like you're a burden, but I've also had friends that are really struggling and I've felt that relief too.
Yes.
When they ask for help, or when they, when they want to talk.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I can relate to that. Recently, I had an experience where I felt like there's a lot going on, feeling heavy, and I met up with a couple of friends and I just put it out there. I don't know where it came from. It was, I guess the tension was building up and I just said, I'm struggling lately. And I felt that relief just to put it out there. I didn't know what it was. And then they started asking me questions. And the more I spoke, the more I started connecting the dots. And I felt great just being able to talk it out with my buddies, did, right? And just putting it out
there. Did it feel better to you? I mean, are you glad you
did? 100%. Yeah. But looking back, I just couldn't believe I even just put it out there like that. It's not just, it's not like me to be just sit down and be like, I'm struggling. Yeah. But it was just building up, right? And yeah.
Well, so what would you say to, so I would imagine like my worst fear in this is doing that and then being met with the blank stare or the, you know, so I guess going into that mindset, worst case scenario, you open up to someone and you don't get the kind of response we're talking about. Like, what would you say to that guy? Do we try again? You know what I mean? How do we?
Yeah,
I'm just trying to acknowledge that fear that is probably there.
It's a tough one because there's been times where I've been vulnerable with some friends and they don't have the capacity or they've made me feel worse, as bad as that sounds, but it's true. So one of the things I've learned about vulnerability is it's like trust, right? Some people have to earn it. So again, this is the other thing I see in social media, right? With the influencers, they're all like, oh, be vulnerable, do this. And it's like, not, there's a time and place for it, right? And people. So for me, I know there's close friends of mine that I share everything with, and it's been something we've developed over time. Now, if you don't have, that's where I was saying or alluding to, it's tricky, right? How do you create that? And I think that's where mentorship can help. There's been one individual in my life whom I've never met. I was put in contact with him through someone we know, and he's been there for me for the last 2-3 years. And all we've done is spoken on the phone, never on video, never met in person. And he's 20 years older than me, but he's listened to some of the hardest things I've had to navigate in life. And I get emotional talking about it because it's been such a gift for me. Wow. That this complete random stranger who's just put his hand on my shoulder and been there. So you can find
it. Can I ask, how do you think that relationship developed? Was it that intention from the start of having that depth of conversation, or did you feel like you cultivated that, or you both cultivated that?
I feel we both cultivated it, but it's so random, right? So like, I was running a local men's group. Someone in my contact saw that and said, hey, you should talk to this person. He's my uncle. He's doing something similar in the States. And we got in touch, we started talking, and before we knew it, it's just that relationship just kind of came out organically.
I love that because it's also, I think we tend to think, maybe this is out of left field, but I feel like we tend to think as men that like we need to just keep and maintain the relationships we have. It almost feels like we have our friends from way back. It's harder to make new friends as a guy as you get older.
Yes.
And I think this is a really important reminder that it does come out of nowhere. I had a similar experience. A guy I had met before, a group of us, we all went to an outdoor gun range together. And we were in my truck. And we just hit it off. And it's turned into like such a supportive, vulnerable, like a level of depth in the relationship that I don't think I would expect out of someone that you just kind of met like that. So I think I'm glad you've had that too. Like, you just have to seize it wherever it comes open, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I personally feel the opportunities are there. You just have, to your point, seek it out and seize it for sure. But so I guess the takeaway here is you're not a burden, but to answer your question, you have to also be mindful of who you seek help from, because some people, and it's not a judgment, just some people are not there to and able to meet you there.
Yep. Well, and I think some people are not there in terms of their capacity, like you said, or also in terms of the work that they're doing.
Yes.
You know, there's just, I've really struggled with that disconnect of turning, I felt like I was turning to people when I was struggling most, and they just didn't get it. They didn't get how bad it was. They didn't get the level of the struggle. They didn't get how much it took me to even bring this up. And I think, you know, it's kind of connected to what you were just saying. When if you have experiences like that, doesn't mean it's everyone. You just kind of have to have that, take a breath, have acceptance of where they are. And it's not what you need right now.
Right, right. And I mean, along those same lines, if you are someone that, you know, a friend or someone close to you or even in your network is reaching out to, you don't have to have any answer or all the answers. All you can do is just listen and ask and maybe even figure out what support looks like for that person. Right. And I find a lot of the times, especially men, and I see this a lot in relationships, romantic relationships specifically, where men feel like they need to solve the problem or have an answer ready, because for that's just how we're wired at times. And it doesn't have to be that, right? When someone's reaching out to you, they just need to talk. So can you just listen and maybe ask questions, be curious, as we talked about earlier. That's all. And in my experiences where I felt I've been vulnerable and it wasn't met, it was just because they were trying to give me an answer, a solution, or solve the problem for me.
Make the problem go away.
Yeah. It's like, I don't need that. You know, like I have the tools and I know, like, I think in my work in therapy, I find a lot, like majority of us know what we need to do. It's just sometimes we need the courage and that comes with time, but you sometimes just need the support to be able to get there.
I completely agree with that. It makes me think about, you know, we started the conversation talking about kind of journalism and witnessing. And I think it's making me immediately think of just like, just that power of being seen.
Yes.
And heard.
Yes.
That in and of itself is such a transformative thing. I've seen that for, you know, immigrants in Turkey. I've seen it in natural disaster victims in Puerto Rico, and I see it with just guys in everyday, you know what I mean? When you're struggling, to just have someone that you respect validate that you're not being a baby, that you're not making it up, that you're not in your head, that does really suck. It is, you know what I mean? That goes so far in just regulating our nervous system to be like, okay, I'm not alone. Somebody gets it.
Yeah, and that's what empathy boils down to, right? And but yeah, Will, thank you so much for this conversation.
Oh, my pleasure.
I had a blast. We did get through quite a bit, so hopefully people were able to keep track. But
I hope so. I appreciate your willingness to kind of stitch these different pieces of my work in this conversation together, because it's like it's brought clarity to me too of like I'm seeing how all of this is, it is all related, both the manosphere, journalism, the state of the world. So yeah, it's great talking to you, man.
Yeah, yeah. So for listeners that want to learn more about your work, and I know you've got some projects in the pipeline if you want to share that as well, but yeah, how can people find your work out there?
Yeah, my website is just my name. It's willpotter.com. I'll make a shameless plug that we just produced 2 audiobooks for both my books that just released last week. So those are available, but also stuff about my work, and people can sign up on my email list on the website, because I'm launching a new YouTube channel and podcast coming soon. That is kind of where all this grew out of.
Yes.
Conversations like this, both explicitly about masculinity and for men, but also about my work and what's going on in the world. So if folks want to check it out, please sign up for that email and it'll be coming soon.
Awesome. Well, thanks again, Will. Really appreciate it and looking forward to
it. My pleasure. Thanks for all the work you're doing, man, and having these conversations. Enjoyed it.
Thank you. Thank you for checking out this episode with Will. As always, please subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or YouTube. That's the best and easiest way to support this podcast. And on Apple and Spotify, you can leave up to a 5-star review.
Please check out the sponsors in the description, as well as the Easy Reflections newsletter, a zero-cost newsletter that goes out weekly, where I explore different mental health topics and provide practical tips and insights for the reader. The link to the newsletter can be found in the show note captions, where you can subscribe directly. Thank you again, and until next time.